Hey y'all, next week marks the 120th anniversary of the Wright brothers' first flight at Kitty Hawk, a flight that many consider to be the first flight ever. While it was a historic flight, today we'll be talking about five aviators who flew before the Wright brothers. This is episode 27 of the Platt Pilot Podcast, and I'm your host, Todd Weld. How are you guys doing out there this week? I'm glad to have you back, glad to be back. The busyness continues for me this week. It's starting to feel like that's just life now. I was able to knock out my flight instructor refresher course online over the last week or two. And as you probably know, I don't have my flight instructor certificate yet. I am still working on my commercial, but one of the requirements to be able to exercise your privileges, or at least one of the ways to be legally allowed to exercise your privileges as an advanced ground instructor, or any level of ground instructor for that matter, is to complete that course. And since I am planning on switching to more flight training focused content, I figured it wouldn't be an awful idea to go ahead and get completely legal. Of course, there wouldn't be anything illegal about me or anyone sharing their aviation knowledge on a podcast or YouTube or even in person, as long as they were upfront and didn't misrepresent their certifications or qualifications, and of course, not issuing any endorsements or anything like that. And I don't plan on endorsing anyone through the podcast anyhow. I don't know that something like that would even be possible if I wanted to. But I just like having all my ducks in a row. And so I went ahead and got that knocked out. So I am fully able to exercise the privileges of the advanced ground instructor in the eyes of the FAA. And I am excited to start sharing some of that content here in the new year. This week, however, we're going to be talking about the Wright brothers, sort of. As you guys know, they are my all-time favorite aviators, and those of you who've been with the podcast for any amount of time probably know that's not the case. They used to be, they did, a long time ago. At one point, they were heroes of mine, but that was back when I didn't really know that much about them, other than the standard they discovered flight that you hear about in school. But that was enough for me. You know, I loved aviation, and I loved airplanes, and these guys supposedly created flight all on their own, and they built their own airplane, and what could be cooler than that, right? Well, years later, I would read a biography about the Wright brothers, and I was devastated to find out the real story. And before I get into that, let me give credit where credit is due. And the Wright brothers were intelligent businessmen. They were great with machines. You know, they had a bicycle shop before and built engines before they set their sights on aviation. And they did successfully build an airplane and completed the first manned, powered, controlled, heavier-than-air flight. However, once they accomplished that feat, they also disassembled and hid their invention for literal years in fear that somebody would copy their work before they were able to secure a patent. So keep in mind, this was an invention that they built on the hard work and research of others. They did put in a lot of their own work as well. I'm not trying to discount that fact, but so much of their research stemmed from the work of others, and it kind of allowed them to, you know, continue on, and they had a good starting point, is what I'm trying to say. And during this time, while they've hidden the aircraft away and they're working on getting a patent secured, they were also trying to secure patents with the U.S. government to sell airplanes to the military. And there's nothing wrong with that. However, in later years, Orville would lament the destructive way that his invention was used. Now, I'm pro-military. I served for a handful of years. My dad served longer than I did. Most of my uncles and a handful of my cousins have served as well. I have nothing against the military. I absolutely support those who served. And it isn't a judgment or a condemnation when I say that the military exists to kill people and break their things. It's just a fact. It's been that way for almost 250 years in the United States, and even longer in other countries. The overarching mission of the United States military, it's changed and evolved, and I would say that more often than not, it's been a good, worthy mission. You know, throughout history, sometimes it's been dealing with tyrannical governments, freeing enslaved peoples, bringing an end to genocide. All of these missions were great missions, and all of them were accomplished by killing people and breaking their things. It's what the military does. So I don't know if he was being overly optimistic about human nature, if he was arrogant enough to believe that they were the only ones who would be able to build an airplane and thinking that it would just be this incredible weapon of war that they were the only ones who could build and world peace would be ushered in because of it, or if he was just really bad at history. But I will never understand how you could put so much effort into selling your invention to an organization that specializes in killing people and breaking their things, and then having the audacity to be shocked when they use it to kill people and break their things. Come on. But aside from this stunning hypocrisy, or whatever you want to call it, they spent an exorbitant amount of time suing people for patent infringement. They didn't want anyone to be able to fly unless they were getting money as a result. Matter of fact, ailerons were actually introduced on aircraft as a result of this whole situation. See, the Wright brothers, they utilized wing warping as a means of aircraft control. So basically, the wing was this one piece, and they actually had to warp the wing, change the shape of the wing, basically bending it to maneuver the aircraft. And many people at the time, they kind of understood, or they thought that they understood, that wing warping was the basis of the patent. So Glenn Curtis, he put some ailerons on his flying machine, and he said, hey, look, we've circumvented the patent, essentially, and we can have controlled flight without the use of wing warping. It was a great situation, so he thought. And he was promptly sued, with the Wright brothers maintaining that it wasn't wing warping that was patented, but it was controlled flight in general. So they're trying to patent this activity, essentially. Now, I don't know how much they really cared about flight beyond a way to make money, but they achieved a milestone that many had worked towards, and they did it slightly ahead of their peers. And they spent the next decade or better trying to stifle any progress in aviation in the name of lost profits. So they're basically putting profits above flying. So I can't imagine they liked it that much. And in a brilliant display of karma, Wilbur, weakened by the stress of just constantly being an awful person, I guess the family would call it litigation and legal battles, tomato, tomato, Wilbur died of typhoid fever in 1912, and basically left Orville to be awful all on his own. Now, when World War I broke out, the realization hit that the U.S. was falling behind in aviation technology, basically as a result of this war path that the Wright brothers, or, you know, at this point just Orville, this war path that they were on to sue anybody who tried to build an airplane. So to get back on a level playing field with the European powers, who weren't having this issue, with the blessing of the U.S. government, the Manufacturers Aircraft Association was formed, and they created this patent pool, and the legal battles immediately ground to a halt. You know, the aircraft manufacturers that were constantly being sued basically almost unionized with, like I said, the blessing of the U.S. government. They said, we're tired of not being at the forefront of aviation because of all of this patent infringement litigation. So World War I breaks out. They're able to bring all that to a stop, and we could finally move forward as a country in the furtherance of safe and effective aviation. But imagine the progress that we lost in that decade or so. So there's a relatively quick history of why I don't like the Wright brothers. You know, we've talked about that a little bit on the show, but never really gone into that much depth of it. But now, hopefully you can understand. Hopefully you learned a little bit about them that you didn't know before. I'm not telling you not to like them, but just know what they did to aviation and make your own decision. And I know no one's perfect. And even some, or probably all of the people from history that I admire, they've done things, they've held values that I wouldn't agree with, I wouldn't condone. But I think in the case of the Wright brothers, it's just the fact that their transgressions were against aviation itself and others who loved aviation. And I don't like that we've forgotten what they did and just made them heroes. But on top of all of that, I feel like they get too much credit for their accomplishments as well. Like I said, give credit where credit's due. But, you know, their first flight, it was historic. I'm not trying to argue that it wasn't. And I don't want to discount milestone that that flight was. But it wasn't as historic as it's often made out to be. They did achieve the first manned, powered, controlled, heavier-than-air flight. And that's a lot of qualifiers. And if you take any of them away, then they lose their status as the first in that accomplishment. For example, they weren't the first humans to fly. They weren't the first humans to enjoy powered or controlled flight. And they didn't even have the first flying airplane, if you count unmanned airplanes. In short, they took all of the accomplishments that others had already developed, and they were able to make them work together and create this first man-powered, controlled, heavier-than-air flight. So today we're going to talk about the five aviators who achieved flight before the Wright brothers, now that we're about halfway through this already. So number one, technically two people share this slot. It was François de Rozier and François Laurent. The title of first in flight, at least that we know of, actually goes to two men back in 1783. That is 1783. And we've talked about them on the podcast previous episode a while back. François de Rozier and François Laurent slipped the surly bonds of Earth on November 21st, 1783, when they rose 500 feet or so, and they were on a platform carried by a silk and paper balloon. And this silk and paper balloon was kept aloft by a fire. Seems kind of dangerous, but that's what they did. About 25 minutes after they took off, they touched down. They were over 5 miles away, and the first manned flight was officially in the books. And it is an interesting point to note that it was 120 years between this first flight of de Rozier and Laurent and the Wright brothers' flight at Kitty Hawk. So the same amount of time between the Kitty Hawk flight and today. And that's how much they missed being the first aviators by. You know, they're often thought of as the first aviators, but they missed it by 120 years. If you took your first flight a year ago, you were closer to beating the Wright brothers to be the first in the air than the Wright brothers were to beating de Rozier and Laurent. Not that that really means anything, but it's a fun thought. So for over 100 years, balloons or lighter-than-air ships would be the only option for people who wanted to take flight. And many did. They accomplished all kinds of feats like crossing the English Channel, carrying the mail, although the mail carrying, it was mostly a novelty thing rather than any kind of regular mail service. But they still did it. Just say that they did it. Number two, Henri Giffard. So on September 24th, 1852, so this is decades after the first balloon flight, a man by the name of Henri Giffard took flight to a whole new level when he built an airship, or a lot of people call them dirigibles, with a steam engine and a rudder. So this took lighter-than-air aircraft from being completely at the mercy of the wind to having some say in where they ended up. Before, you'd take off, and then if you were, you knew what the wind was doing, you could use the wind to kind of guide you and end up where you wanted to be, more or less, based on altitude and stuff like that. But you were completely at the mercy of the wind, and you could try and harness that energy to end up where you wanted to go, but it was, at the end of the day, completely up to the wind. But now, with the steam engine and the rudder, they're able to manipulate that a little bit. So on this first flight, Henri traveled 17 miles and took him a little while to cover that distance, partially because he just wasn't moving very fast, but also he was demonstrating his maneuvering capability along the way, showing people that he could make turns and do some lazy S turns and stuff like that, showing that he was controlling the ship. Unfortunately, when he got to his destination 17 miles away, he tried to make a return trip, and he found out that the steam engine on board wasn't powerful enough to overcome the force of the wind. So the elements were far from conquered. Some work still had to be done if they wanted to, you know, completely maneuver in any direction, but powered, controlled flight had officially been accomplished. Number three, Otto Lilienthal. So in 1891, a gentleman by the name of Otto Lilienthal began to make his foray into the world of heavier-than-air aircraft. Now, I did an episode about him a while back. It was at the beginning of the podcast. I think it was like episode three. And I had the privilege of speaking with a gentleman named Traff Doherty. And Traff worked with, may still, I'm not sure, at the time he worked with the National Soaring Museum up in New York. And Otto Lilienthal studied the art and the science of gliding. So a lot of people actually consider him the father of flight today because he was really the first person, at least that we know of, to be able to conduct experiments with a device that was heavier than air and achieve any level of repeatable success. So there had been some gliding experiments previously, some that you might even call successful, but none that were repeatably successful. Or successful repeatedly, I guess would be the right way to say that. And I suppose the argument could be made that since he never landed at a location above the elevation he launched from, that he never truly achieved flight. But he truly achieved something. I think anyone could argue that. And I would venture to call it flight. His longest glides were close to 1,000 feet, and you know, lasted 12 to 15 seconds in duration, which meant that he flew or glided, whatever you want to call it, about as long time-wise as the Wright brothers, and distance-wise, over 8 times the distance of the Wright brothers' first flight. So faster and further than the Wright brothers in a controllable, it was weight shift controllable, you move your weight around, and it would maneuver on some level. So weight shift controllable, heavier than air machine. Now, Otto Lilienthal, he played an even bigger role in aviation than beating the Wright brothers to controlled manned heavier than air flight. Of course, that was a big one. But his research and experimentation, which he'd been working on for years before he actually made any experiments, was being used by a lot of people who were trying to develop functional airplanes. So I don't remember how long it was that he'd studied, but he studied for a long time and he wrote books and, you know, had compiled all of this research before he even built his machine. And so a lot of people were using this. And Lilienthal never corresponded directly with the Wright brothers, but he did write many letters to a gentleman by the name of Octave Chanute, who in turn corresponded with the Wright brothers. So basically, Chanute was the middleman between Lilienthal and the Wright brothers. So they didn't get any information directly from Lilienthal, but they did from Chanute, who got it directly from Lilienthal. And Lilienthal and Chanute were huge proponents of getting the problem of flight solved. They wanted people to fly, essentially. And Chanute and the Wright brothers, although they were really good friends at one point, they found themselves being torn apart by differing values. As it became clear that if the Wright brothers achieved a flying machine, that they would do everything in their power to keep anyone else from being able to produce their own flying machines. So Chanute felt that aviation belonged to the masses, and the Wright brothers felt that it belonged to them alone, or probably to whoever created it first, but they wanted it to be them. So this kind of bitter end took place to that friendship and a partnership which helped the Wright brothers in their own pursuits. But the pursuit of a heavier-than-air machine that was controllable and capable of traveling significant distances through the air and bringing a human from a higher altitude to the ground safely, at least more often than not was safe, had been accomplished. Number 4, Samuel Langley. The next barrier to be overcome would be powered heavier-than-air flight. And a gentleman named Samuel Langley crossed that off the old bucket list on May 6, 1896, which was over 7.5 years before the Wright brothers made their famous flight at Kitty Hawk. Now, this flight didn't count as controllable. It wasn't controllable in any way. And it wasn't a manned flight, but Langley did build an aircraft of significant size. I think it was 30 pounds or so. And it had an engine on it. And it was able, I think on the first flight, it flew over 3,300 feet. Later, it would fly over 4,000 feet, you know, the better part of a mile. And that is over 27 times the distance the Wright brothers flew, and 7 years and some change earlier than they did it. Granted, it was unmanned, it was much smaller, and it was uncontrolled, but it showed that heavier than air powered flight was more than possible. All that needed to be done was to scale it up and to scale it up with enough margin to put a person on board. Obviously, it's easier said than done, but Langley was well on his way to doing that. In the time period a couple months to a couple weeks before the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk, Langley would actually perform a couple tests of his manned aircraft launched from a houseboat catapult. Sadly, both of the tests would fail, and Langley ended up just thrown in the towel and being done with aircraft development. But he had something that was on the cusp of working. A decade later, Glenn Curtis would actually make some modifications to Langley's design, trying to prove that it was capable of flying, and basically just to discredit the Wright brothers' patent claims, His hope was that he could say Langley was the first to fly, or the first who had built an airplane that could fly. And so all of this Wright brothers' patent claims are null and void, but the modifications that he had to make were too extensive, and it's likely that despite being better intentioned than the Wright brothers, Langley's design just wasn't as good. He'd obviously passed the hurdle of designing usable airfoil, which I imagine back then was, you know, figuring out how to create lift with a shape, because the aerodrome flew the better part of a mile, like we said. But when you have to scale that up to be able to hold a person, there were just some structural issues that he really struggled with. But he still achieved powered, heavier than air flight, even if he was never able to put a person in the air. And obviously the problem of making an aircraft large enough to support a person while still being light or powerful enough, or a combination of the two, to take off was a difficult one to solve. However, it may have been partially solved much sooner than most people give it credit for. Many people claimed to have made short hops, or even more than short hops, in aircraft that they had built well before the Wright brothers. Or at least a little before the Wright brothers. Many of these were proven to be fabrications. Most of them were proven to be fabrications. But one does hold a little bit of weight, even if it's generally regarded as false as well. So Gustav Whitehead, originally Gustav Weisskopf, he changed his name when he immigrated from Germany, claimed to have made a handful of flights between 1899 and 1902. And there were some people who claimed to be witnesses. But years later, you know, they were given some affidavits and stuff like that, and they were found to be inconsistent in their stories, which may or may not mean anything. Eyewitness testimony is proven to be fairly unreliable. I know people hate to hear that because you think of eyewitness testimony as the most important kind of testimony, but especially when you start talking about details of stuff years later, especially. It is fairly unreliable. However, the aircraft was later inspected by employees of the Smithsonian. And keep in mind, the Smithsonian had a vested interest in disproving the Wright brothers as the first to fly. And these inspectors still, after looking at it, found it unlikely that the machine would have been capable of flight. They looked at Whitehead's, one of his aircraft, and they said it almost certainly wouldn't have been able to fly. So like I said, he most likely never achieved flight either, but of all of the people who had claimed to, he was probably, in this time frame, he was probably the most likely. However, a decade before Whitehead may or may not have actually flown, we find our final pre-Wright aviator. Number 5, Clement Ater. In 1890, a man by the name of Clement Ater designed a batwing monoplane that was able to take off under its own power, and this was in France. And the two things that keep this flight from being regarded as a true flight by most people are the fact that it was, quote, unsustained and uncontrolled. And I'll give them uncontrolled. Mr. Ater didn't have any kind of way to control his aircraft. However, his first flight was over 160 feet. That's 40 feet longer than the Wright brothers achieved with their first flight. So I don't know what the definition of unsustained or sustained is as it pertains to qualifying as a flight. However, it seems to me that a hop of 160 feet should qualify. And nobody's questioning the validity of the Wright brothers' 120 feet. Actually, that's not exactly true. There have been some questions about what was actually achieved at Kitty Hawk. There's no doubt that the aircraft left the ground and traveled through the air for something like 120 feet. The question is whether they landed at or above the elevation that they launched from. So they were launching from sand dunes at Kitty Hawk. And it would be difficult or impossible to definitively say one way or the other with these changing dunes, whether it was a powered glide or what many would consider true flight. But here's my thing with that. I'm not going to speculate or even care whether the first flight was a powered glide or something more. It doesn't matter to me. I'm giving credit to Lilienthal for his glides, and we know for sure that later the Wright brothers were able to achieve true, pure flight, no matter how you slice it. I think I made it abundantly clear how I feel about the Wright brothers as people, but I still want to be fair. They were brilliant men. They were brilliant businessmen, ethics aside. And although they built their machines and achieved flight based off the hard work and research of others, they also contributed their own hard work and research, and I will always be grateful for the part that they played in the multitude of people who made it possible for me to hop in a modern-day flying machine and experience the joy of flight. I just wish that they would have acted more in the interest of aviation and less in the bottom line. Well, that's all for this week. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. To make sure you never miss an episode, be sure to follow the podcast on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I hope to catch you next week, but until then, y'all stay safe out there. Keep the dirty side down, the pointy end forward, and as my wife always says, fluffy landings.